This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. It's no longer about polls and predictions. It's about real votes. Over 4,382,000 Ohioans, 54.3% of all registered voters, went to the polls on Tuesday. Or in early votes, in Hamilton County, over 332,800 people, or 55.7%, participated. Both in terms of percentage and of turnout in absolute number, the votes cast, those were near record levels for midterm elections. Today, we dig into the results and try to figure out the implications. We begin locally and are joined by Cincinnati Enquirer regional government reporter Scott Wortman, Cincinnati Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wetterig, and WVXU reporters Howard Wilkinson and Bill Reinhardt. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Twitter and Facebook. Welcome, everybody. The Friday of election week. I wonder what we'll talk about.
Slow news week.
Yeah, right. So anyway, Scott, let's begin with the Steve Chabot, AFTAB Purevall congressional race. One of the insights from this for me is it shows the power of drawing the congressional district. It really, the spreads in the two counties that this race was run in really defines almost everything.
Absolutely. Chabot really ran up the score in Warren County, and there's really no way AFTAB Purevall, the Democrat, could have overcome that in Hamilton County. He would have had to won the vote in Hamilton County, Chabot's backyard, by more than 60% to overcome the 33,000 vote margin that Chabot won Warren County by. There are just a lot of Republicans up north.
Yeah, I was at the Board of Elections on election night and waiting for the Warren County vote to come in. And when I saw that final vote and it was like, oh boy, there's not much of a prayer here. Howard, what do you think of that? And is there any way for a Democrat to win this district?
Yes, there is. One way is not to get in trouble every 5 minutes and be dragged before the Ohio Elections Commission with some fairly serious charges, even though they didn't amount to anything in the first round. The Democrats looked at that district and said, okay, this is the district in all of Ohio that where Donald Trump had the smallest margin of victory in a Republican area. And they said, this is an opportunity. And there was a narrow window for a candidate like AFTAB Purevall, who, you know, was a new face, different kind of guy. The demographics are changing in Warren County, believe it or not, just as they have in Hamilton County over the years. And it's just going to continue to do that, you know, from the south moving north in Warren County. But he blew it. I mean, he just plain blew it. And he let the Chabot campaign define him. And was outspent by Paul Ryan's super PAC, and just, you know, I mean, he was just totally inundated.
Yeah. Chris, for a young politician who obviously has a lot of talent, won a sort of a surprise race 2 years ago, now has taken this loss, what does he have to do to handle this loss in order to preserve some sort of future in the long run? And in fact, could having a loss early in your career teach you a lot about what you need to do?
Oh, it's a good thing sometimes to lose. Mm-hmm. I mean, Barack Obama in the state of Illinois, he ran for Congress and got his hat handed to him the first time. He ran against a veteran politician there, and that's
so did Abraham Lincoln, by the way.
And Lincoln lost many. Well, he lost a few races.
Well, you look closer to home. Look at David Pepper. When David Pepper ran for mayor, and he ran a very bad campaign against Mark Mallory, and Mark Mallory won. He did learn from that, and then a couple years later, he came back and won the county commission seat.
And I think another analogy, because this was a high-profile race, got national coverage. He's got a lot of name recognition out of this. And it's not unlike Matt Bevin in Kentucky in 2014, ran against McConnell, got trounced. A year later, he's governor.
Chris?
And I didn't mean to compare AFTAB to Barack Obama. There's too many Democrats in town who – you know, have made that comparison, and I didn't see it the whole race. He ran kind of a DC campaign. He came out talking about Trump and, how terrible he was. And later on in the campaign, that stopped when I think they looked at the polling data and saw that Trump was kind of even here, maybe above water in the first congressional district in terms of the number of people who approved of the president. Then you didn't hear as much criticism of him. And then in the debate, you saw some more criticisms where he was saying, oh, I'm not going to tweet out my trade policy or whatever. So I think it is a whole learning experience. And he probably ought to be focused on winning re-election as Hamilton County Clerk of Courts in 2 years. Or
he's got two more years to work.
Running for prosecutor maybe there or mayor of Cincinnati. I don't see that one happening as much. But, the Democrats proved on Tuesday that they can win any county office, I think, that they want if they really put their minds to it.
And if the district was the same as the first congressional district was the same as it was in 2008, AFTAB would have easily won because that was mostly just Hamilton County with a sliver of Butler County.
Yeah, right.
And AFTAB easily won Hamilton County.
But that's why they changed that district to secure that seat for Steve.
Oh, absolutely.
There's a reason.
He listened a little bit too much to the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee because that was what they were telling candidates like AFTAB all over the country, you know, run against Trump, run against Trump, run against Trump. Yeah. That didn't work.
This whole concept of this election was nationalized and it was all about Trump. There's not that that wasn't a factor, but ultimately, politics is local, and for somebody who's been around as long as Steve Chabot, you've got to deal with the real local dynamic, I think, too. One of the questions I had, though, was it seems to me as this race went on, the Republicans were not out not just to beat AFTAB Purevall, but to make sure that what they brought up in this race is going to be brought up again and again for the foreseeable future.
Yes. Election night, one of Chabot's campaign people had put out a tweet in which they said, we're going to crack his head like a walnut.
Who was that? I didn't see that one.
Speaking of Hamilton County, because I think
it's true. That's what happened.
That's what we want to get to. And Bill, we can do this on several different levels, but probably the biggest news in Hamilton County, the biggest surprise, but biggest news in Hamilton County is that Stephanie Dumas beat Chris Monzel, a longtime, incumbent Republican establishment, by 8,400 votes. It wasn't, it was pretty comfortable, actually. So talk to me about how do you think that happened, and then what does it mean?
I have no idea. Honestly, since Tuesday night, I don't know how this came to be. I talked to her Tuesday night, and she said to her campaign she did not knock on a single door, which seems counterintuitive. I mean, if you're not getting out there and people don't know who you are, why are you getting votes? But she still got the votes. I don't get out into the neighborhoods as often as I ought to, so I don't know if, she just had a lot of yard signs. I didn't see a lot of advertising for her.
No. I think women were fired up.
Yeah, I think.
And they were, you saw it in the judicial races, too. The two that the Democrats didn't win were incumbent Republican women. And, I just think that women were fired up and they were going to vote for women. And that's what happened in the primary with Stephanie Dumas is that the Democrats had a experienced, endorsed white male to run for that seat.
James Wolf.
And, the base of the party is women. And they said, no, we're not doing that.
But even the Republican Party people I talked to, they have no explanation for this either. They're still trying to figure it out. They're trying to crunch the numbers and see if that is, in fact, the case.
Well, let's not just talk about is. Let's just not talk about the election, Bill. For the first time in any human being's living memory, and so I'm not quite sure how far back. I got a suspicion that maybe back in the 1880s there might have been, when the parties meant something completely different.
Yeah.
There might have been three members on the county commission from the Democratic Party. It would have been a very different Democratic Party. But what does this mean going forward? We've now, since 2000, when Todd Portune won for the county commission, and everybody was like, a Democrat on the county commission? Now we've got three Democrats on the county commission, everybody.
It would be easy to say that, well, we've got three Democrats, so they're just going to steamroll through whatever Todd Portune wants, Todd Portune is going to get. But Stephanie Dumas assures me she's not going to rubber stamp anything. She's going to look over everything, and she's going to vote her conscience. She's going to not just be the yes voter for Todd Portune or for Denise Driehaus.
And really, on commission, the dynamic changed in 2016 when Denise made it a Democratic majority. The Democrats and Todd Portune have been able to do pretty much what they want, and Chris Monzelo, he could protest, but he didn't have veto power or couldn't stop anything.
But I think this is – oh, go ahead, Harn.
Well, Todd has tried to make sure he's got consensus on everything. I mean, they haven't always voted 3-0 on everything. You know, Chris has put up some fights and said no, and it's been a 2-1 vote. For instance, the proposed sales tax earlier this year, he said no. It still was enacted and eventually retracted. But for the most part, I saw Todd Portune and Denise Driehaus trying to get Monzel's vote so they would have a 3-0. They would have unanimous decisions.
They were real perturbed at the fact that Chris Monzel would not vote to put the Children's Services levy on the ballot. That was another one. Chris is just not going to vote for tax increases. That's the bottom line.
But it still got on the ballot.
It did, yeah.
And won.
And passed, yes.
And won.
I think it's an opportunity for the Democrats to really, you know, do some interesting things. I don't know how much they've thought about it or not, but, I mean, it raises all kinds of issues. You know, we talked about metro government in the past, and one of those obstacles was the county was controlled by Republicans and the city by Democrats. I wonder if that is something that will come back up. Portune, you know, this is how much of a nerd I am. I remember back in, I think it was his 2014 or 15 budget when he was in the minority, he had an idea of transitioning the county to a charter form, an executive form of government, right, which is what is in Cuyahoga County today, and I think also Summit County, where Akron is.
Right. Yeah.
So, it just opens up all kinds of possibilities, the fact that they have all of the votes there now. I think there could be some interesting policy coming out of there.
And even with the Democrats in control of the county commission, it's still very much the county versus the city more than Democrats versus Republicans.
Yeah, I don't think there's a Democratic platform.
Right.
Yeah. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. On Tuesday, City of Cincinnati voters approved 5 of 6 charter amendments on the ballot. How will these change the way City Council and City Hall operate? To explore that and also the meaning of the Democratic strong showing on the county side in the courts, we are joined today by Cincinnati Enquirer regional government reporter Scott Wortman, the Cincinnati Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich, and WVXU reporters Howard Wilkinson and Bill Reinhardt. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 513-419-7100. Or email us at talk@wvxu.org. I want to pick up a little bit on the showing of the Democrats in these judicial races. It's, I'm old enough, Howard, you're old enough, to remember when running as a Democrat in this county for a judicial seat was really hard. And in 2 common pleas seats, and in 3 First District Court of Appeals seats, Democrats came out on top on this one. This is really what does this tell us? What's underlying all of this? And maybe goes along with the commission being taken over completely by Democrats.
I think it most definitely does. I mean, I think what you're seeing in this, but also around the country, around the state, is a concentration of Democrats in the more urban areas and the Republicans in the rural and suburban areas. And I personally, I think that's basically the main factor at play here.
It's a demographic issue.
Scott's exactly right. But you also have to remember, all of these judicial candidates are on the ballot without a party designation. So the political party itself, like the Democratic Party, had to go out and basically educate its base, their base voters, to say, look, here are the people that you need to vote for. These are our candidates. And they did a very good job of that. They had 200,000 slate cards that were passed out at the polling places on Tuesday. 200,000 is a lot. They had about 150 paid outside poll workers passing those things out, plus well over 100 volunteers at polling places. And they weren't putting them in Covedale. They were putting them in. They were putting them at Democratic precincts where they were going to have the biggest effect.
And the reality is,
and they're just better at this kind of thing.
The reality is people may go in knowing who they're going to vote for governor,
right,
who they're going to vote for senator and for congressman. But when you get to the judges, not only aren't there any D or R behind the name, but people just don't know who these people are.
A lot of people do not.
So they leave them blank.
This was a long time coming. What happened on Tuesday with the judges, this is a blue county now. And it wasn't just at the polls on Tuesday, they were coming in the mail too. I mean, the best you can hope with a mailer is that someone sees that name before you throw it in the trash. And actually, one of the last ones I got that said, "Don't throw this away. You have to vote for the judges." And they did an excellent, excellent job.
Historically, the fall off for people who voted,
Democrats don't finish their ballots. They just
don't. Well, it's not just Democrats, but 30% of all people who vote historically do not vote for judges. They just don't feel ready to. They don't feel like they have enough information.
And anecdotally, but to follow up on what Howard said, I mean, I think he's right. They really did put in the legwork. There wasn't a week that went by that I didn't see Pierre Bergeron, who won on the Court of Appeals somewhere at some event, or just running to him on the street. I mean, they really did pound the pavement.
And he was on TV, too, in the last couple of days of the election, which I think helped him as well.
All about name recognition. Once you get into that ballot box, you get down towards the end, it's like, that name sounds familiar. Why not?
Yeah. So
we should also note that the Democratic statewide candidates, all five constitutional officers, they also won this county in a big way.
And yes.
Howard, I don't know when the last time that happened. Ted Strickland didn't win this county in 2006 when he had a landslide victory throughout the rest of the state.
But I was surprised even Jill Schiller won Hamilton County, even though she got trounced by Winthrop.
Yeah, she got trounced because, Claremont County. Yeah, Claremont County. I mean, we talk about Warren County in the first district, but Claremont County is the big stumbling block for Democrats in the second district.
I'm not going to let go of these judges for a minute because some of these were just they're newcomers, but there were two races here. One, Terry Nestor overcoming Steve Martin, who's a longtime incumbent on the Common Pleas Court, and Candace Krause beating Dennis Dieters, who certainly has a ballot name and name recognition in this county.
Former county commissioner.
Former county commissioner appointed to the bench.
To the commission.
These are interesting appointed to the commission too. These are interesting victories, I think. And they tell us something that reinforces what Howard's saying.
Or it could be partially reverse of what I just said, not recognizing their names, wanting some change, saying, well, I don't recognize this name, so that's who the person I'm going to vote for. Maybe.
That's an interesting theory. that would blow the field operation of every office, every candidate right out. Of course, Stephanie Dumas did not knock on any doors either.
Bill, you just made at least 100 political consultants cry.
But that's what reporters have those thoughts.
Well, right. Stephanie didn't knock on any doors. I think she would tell you that she did go to all these festivals because it was a hilarious quote. I think it was in your story, Scott, where she was like, well,
I think it's rude when people come to my door at dinner, so she didn't want to do it.
Yeah, I don't want to intrude it's on really, someone's dinner,
Really unorthodox way of looking at it.
I think that is a good distinction, because she did put in legwork. She just didn't do the traditional, canvassing a neighborhood.
Right.
She went to festivals, Democratic events, and she said that she was there every day for the last month at the Board of Elections greeting people. So.
Yep. Yeah, she was. I know that because I saw her there on a number of situations. So anyway, we do have a caller, and I want to make sure that we get the call in. And Gene, you have a question about down ballot races.
Well, I had a comment. I live downtown Cincinnati, and I voted all the down ballots for Democrats. And I did get a lot of brochures in the mail telling who are the judges, who are for the local courts. And then I went and picked up, well, they put them in the lobby of my building, but they have them at the library, the League of Women Voters papers.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That describes all the races, the people you can read about. And then they have the sample ballot on the back. So then I check them all off. And so when I go into the polls, I'm ready to just start coloring. I don't have to read each issue. So that's one way. But I did see a lot of brochures in the mail talking about down ballot, who is judges, who's this, who's common pleas. And I think that's also what turned out to vote for all those down races, too.
Yeah. So here's a voter who really paid attention.
That's right. And that's the kind of voter that they're looking for. And you don't just contact someone like Gene once. You contact her over and over and over again until you know for a fact that she's voted, either voted early or voted on Election Day.
Right. Chris, you look like you're about to say something.
Oh, no. I was just staring off into space there, Dan. Sorry.
Right. Okay.
I have nothing to add.
All right. Let's move on before we run out of time with over to the city of Cincinnati. There were six charter amendments, constitutional amendments for all practical purposes, on the ballot. Five of them passed. 10 and 11 were both about the same thing. And 10 won 70 to 30. 11 lost, but just barely. And so clearly now that's the one we're going to go back to 2-year terms. How will this change dynamics at City Hall? That's my question.
It means that they're going to be, going back to the business community for money, which I think might have been the point of the amendment. And it might.
What do you mean by that?
Well, if you're in a 4-year term, you don't have to raise money in that first year of office, maybe not even the second year. You don't have to raise too much anyway. If you're in a 2-year term, you're going to start in January, and by June or July, you're going to start thinking about reelection. And I think the point of this amendment was to put a little bit of a leash on some of these council members who are doing things like questioning development deals and whether we should build new stadiums. And
so in other words, the people who give money – people in the business community, for example, one source.
Some of them said, I don't want
access.
Yeah. Well, they want access and they want a more powerful mayor. And, I think there is some division on this. I think I heard some of the business community folks say, I don't want these guys calling me, every.
That's the other side of that.
Yeah.
Right.
But I'll tell you, the powers that be do. And so that was, I think, the driving force. They have to remember, though, things happen in politics, right? Like in 2011, the city elected 7 Democrats to city council. And that was the year, of course, of SB 5, which brought out labor and Democrats in a big way to kill that. But, just because you have 2-year terms doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get a more compliant council for what you want to do if you're the business community.
No. And one of the reasons that 4-year terms – you have some candidates who run once and they do fairly well. They're not, they come up short. People look at them and say, they could be council members someday, but then they would have to sit around for 4 years and try to keep their names out there before they could try it again. And that's almost an incumbent protection act.
It's tough.
It's very tough. And at least I think now with the 2-year terms, and Chris is absolutely right, they're going to go back into the cycle of constant fundraising and constant campaigning from the
– Will this mean that they will get less meaningful work done at council?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, you know, because they're going to have to do something in an election year.
I've never bought that as a reason to do two or a reason to do four. I mean, they're perfectly capable of doing meaningful work either way.
Okay. I want to get at one other one.
And sometimes they do.
Yeah.
And that was issue 12, which will now allow counsel to go into executive session to talk about personnel, lawsuits, and property questions. Will this make counsel more orderly?
Orderly. That's orderly. An interesting way of putting it. I doubt it. I think it'll make it more difficult for the public to see what's going on. And, you know, this was a weirdly I didn't realize the wording of this until I saw it on my own ballot. That's how badly reported, I think, on this was. It basically had no mention of the word executive session. All it said was, should we repeal such and such section of the charter and follow the State Open Meetings Act? If you're a voter, you're reading that and thinking, well, yes, I would like them to follow the State Open Meetings Act. That's a good idea. And of course, that's why it passed overwhelmingly. I would not be surprised sometime in the future if they do something scandalous in executive session to see this back on the ballot someday.
You mean that we've actually sort of flipped back and forth on stuff like this?
We do, yes.
Keeps things going. So
there's
anyway.
An insatiable desire to amend the City of Cincinnati's charter, and that's why you saw five amendments. Yeah.
Which takes up a whole shelf.
It's about a page.
At the law library. So, Scott and Bill, thank you for joining us today. Chris and Howard, please stay with us, and we're going to turn our attention to statewide issues right after the break. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Tuesday, Republicans statewide landed decisive wins in the hotly contested governor's race and four statewide offices. The Democrats held the Senate seat and surprisingly took both Supreme Court seats on the ballot. To shed some light on the results, we are joined now by Public Radio and Television Statehouse News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler, Cincinnati Enquirer Bureau Chief Jackie Bouchard, Cincinnati Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich, and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. Welcome, everybody, to the analysis here of the statewide. Karen, I don't know. I think it was about 10 days before the election last Tuesday that you did a report saying that the governor's race was so close that we would probably not know the results at the end of the night, and it would take some time after that. So what do you think happened in the closing days of the race? Because in the end, this wasn't particularly close.
Well, I think the way that I reported it was that it could happen, that if indeed the polls were correct, that there was going to be this very, very close race, that it could go to provisional ballots. And the polls were suggesting it was going to be a super close race. The polls, while within the margin of error, turned out to not be exactly accurate in the sense of predicting that we were going to get the spread that we did. And so I think a lot of people were surprised that indeed it was about a 4-point spread with all of the statewide executive offices, and indeed the U.S. Senate race was a lot closer than a lot of people expected. So kind of that was the opposite end, where people, I think, thought Sherrod Brown was just going to run right over Jim Renacci, and it looked like that in the early voting and in the early hours of the night. But then the gap narrowed, and he ended up beating Renacci by about 6 points. But yeah, the races for governor, auditor, secretary of state, treasurer, attorney general, they all turned out to be a little bit further apart than I think a lot of polls suggested. And so we ended up by the end of the night definitely knowing that Mike DeWine was elected governor.
Karen, I said the same thing about the governor's race about the same time. I mean, it looked like it was going to go that way.
Yeah, I mean, the polls really seem to suggest that it was going to be a very competitive race. And we've seen very competitive races in Ohio, but this was just not one of them. And I think, you know, it really does speak to the idea that Ohio is a Republican state in these midterm elections. This is the third one in a row. And I know 2014 was a little weird, but this is the third one in a row where Republicans have run the table on these five executive statewide offices.
Karen, you just said something, though. We opened the show by observing that Republican leaders at this point are saying Ohio is no longer a swing state. It's a red state. You're saying your qualification there was in midterm elections.
Yeah. And I'm working on a story right now that specifically addresses that idea, whether Ohio is a red state or indeed still a swing state. I don't know if we know if Ohio is still a swing state. I think we find that out in 2 years. But certainly in these midterm elections, the argument could be made that in these elections where we elect governor and the other executive offices, the electorate is smaller, fewer people turn out, and they tend to be more Republican. And I think we saw that in these results.
You know, the interesting thing about the pre-election polling to me was that it just pointed to a Cordray victory because it showed Trump underwater in his job approval rating. And after the election, we saw the CNN exit polls for this state, and it showed Trump's approval rating was 53%. And it was they didn't game the electorate right in the pre-election polling. It looks to me.
And Trump, to tell you the truth, I mean, I think that there was a certain amount of when he came in the day before the election and goes up to the IX Center in Cleveland and holds a big rally with Mike DeWine. And Mike DeWine, who had been kind of keeping his distance from Trump and from Kasich, by the way. But when they were together, and I think that probably convinced a whole lot of the Trump voters from 2016, who are not necessarily Republicans, to get on board. And he put Mike DeWine on his back and carried him across the line.
So you do think that in Ohio, President Trump really did make the difference?
I do.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
The Appalachian counties along West Virginia and Eastern Kentucky's border – that was a bloodbath for Democrats. They lost all of those counties by 30 to 40 points in some cases.
Well, actually, we had a email come in, and I think the person's name is Joe, but I'm not real sure, wonders about whether David Pepper, who's the chair of the Democratic Party in Ohio, needs to get someone who understands campaigning in rural counties. That maybe he's too urban focused.
This conference that I saw yesterday specifically talked about that, and I'm working on a story, like I mentioned earlier, about that Aaron Pickerel, who ran the Ohio campaigns for Obama and Ted Strickland, said pretty much exactly the same thing, that there is this urban-rural divide and that Democrats do need to get better about speaking to these rural voters. I mean, when you look at the counties that went for Cordray, there really aren't that many in rural areas. I mean, the most rural one is Athens County, which, you know, Republicans will joke and call it the People's Republic of Athens.
It's Ohio. Yeah, right. I mean, it's Ohio University. The Democrats are always going to win that one, right?
I mean, yeah. No, I think that's, exactly right. They have to get better at this. And I think it started with Hillary Clinton in 2016, where they just kind of seemed to write off that whole area.
Need to find a message and an approach.
Yeah, they need to find a message and an approach and a candidate who is willing to talk to those people directly. And
the suggestion yesterday was Sherrod Brown is that guy.
And Sherrod Brown is that guy up to to a great extent.
I do wonder if the Democrats had Brown for governor and Cordray for Senate, whether it would have been different, whether
it could have been.
It would have trickled down from Brown.
Sherrod certainly has a lot more that he can say that would appeal to those people in those parts of the state.
Jackie, on the other statewide races, attorney general, auditor, secretary of state, treasurer, there was no Republican who was an incumbent in the seat that they were running for. Now, there were some names there that people knew because they had held other seats. Yost, obviously, Faber. what do you see, what's sort of your perspective on the pretty consistent result in those four races? How do you fit that into this larger picture?
Well, I think that shows that generally voters didn't know much about those candidates, and that they were probably going with their party, you know, straight party ticket. I think looking at the Supreme Court seats is interesting because Democrats won both of those seats in contested races against Republicans. But those candidates don't appear with their party affiliation on their name on the ballot. So if you're voting your ballot straight party, you go down and you're, you know, picking all the Republicans, and then you get to these two races, you're not going to see an R or a D. So, you know, it's up to, you know, the voter to have studied up on those candidates. And in most cases, I think voters don't pay attention to the judicial races. And so then they're going off name recognition or a name that just sounds good. And, you know, one of the Democrats who won is Judge Michael Donnelly. And I was talking with someone, a longtime Republican strategist today, and he said that's a winning name. I mean, you put anybody
put any
against
Irish
a Donnelly.
Name on
Maybe if you put a Kennedy against a Donnelly, right. you might lose.
Yeah, right.
But Irish names, Scottish names, you know, Brown is a popular one as well. Brown is a popular judge. You know, if you're a judge with the last name Brown and you're running, you've got a good chance. So, you know, when you look at that, it makes sense that the down tickets all went Republican by roughly about the same margin.
Does this say, though, that we ought to rethink how the judicial candidates are presented? Or should they have D's and R's behind their name? Because they're definitely recruited by the two parties.
Well, and they run in partisan primaries.
They run in partisan
primaries. Yeah, so, they do. Yeah,
so, you know, Ohio is kind of a weird hybrid where we say we're doing a nonpartisan election, but it really is a partisan election because these folks were selected
so
by
neither,
their parties.
Neither fish nor fowl.
No.
I mean,
yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And you know, states do this differently. Some states have a governor that appoints. Some states do a merit-based, you know, people apply, and then they are confirmed. And then, you know, if they want to hold their seat, then they're put to an election. I mean, there's several different ways to do this.
Yeah.
I don't know that – I don't see that that's changing anytime soon. I think there's quite a bit of support for the way that Ohio does it within Ohio, but it's certainly different than the other races.
And at least we could say – there may be argument, there may be support for it, but there are also some problems with it because people have a hard time figuring out, even if you're working on it, trying to figure out who you ought to vote for. So what about issue one? Issue one went down pretty soundly. Is there anything to say about issue one, both either as the dynamics of that race or what it might mean for the future? Did it introduce some topics and some issues and bring them to the fore, even though it lost?
It reminds me a little bit of the marijuana legalization. After that issue went down in flames, the Republican legislature went back and passed medical marijuana. It seems like they always take, you know, kind of a policy lesson from it, and you kind of hear rumblings about that now as well.
Right.
Well, I think Jackie can speak to how well the marijuana issue is going in Ohio in terms of the legislation that's putting that into play. But I think one thing that's interesting about this is the third time in 4 years that there's been this big money constitutional amendment presented to voters, and they soundly rejected it. That one you're talking about in 2015 was rejected by about a 2 to 1 margin. Then, of course, last year you had the Drug Price Relief Act that sought to lower the price of prescription drugs. That lost 80% to 20%. And so now you have state legislators not only talking about what can be done on criminal justice reform and drug treatment and that sort of thing, which were the issues that were involved in issue one, but they're also talking about how to change the way that people get to the ballot and maybe raising the number of signatures required or that sort of thing, because they're very concerned. The legislative leaders said yesterday at this conference, House Speaker Ryan Smith and Senate President Larry Obhoff said yesterday they're very concerned about the Constitution being used in this way to try to pass legislation. But these groups say, hey, they're doing this because they don't feel that lawmakers are doing enough on these topics.
And I think that point about using the Constitution to make these sorts of changes that really ought to go through the legislature was one of the issues that in every debate I saw about this issue was brought up. You know, should this be a constitutional amendment? Is this the way to even handle this? So what you're saying is increasing, making it harder to get to the ballot. Is that anti-democratic? Is that – how is that going to sell? And who can make that change? Does that require an amendment or is that just law?
It does require an amendment.
That would require a constitutional amendment.
But the legislature
has a much easier time putting a measure on the ballot. It just takes, you know, a vote of them. And then those tend to do much better at the ballot. You know, like three-fourths of these citizen-initiated amendments ultimately fail. So I think there's a question there, too, of, you know, how difficult do you want to make it? It's already fairly difficult in Ohio. It's a decent sized bar, especially if you're a grassroots group or a truly, you know, citizen oriented group. It's near impossible to get on the ballot unless you have a couple million dollars to help you get signatures. And then you have to run an educational campaign to combat the, you know, negative side that's going to come out. So, I mean, these are all things that they're looking at, you know, a couple years ago. There was a group that was looking specifically at all aspects of the Ohio Constitution to see, you know, what needed to be fixed. Because, you know, it's an old document and times change. And one of the things they looked at was this very issue. And one of the things they considered was making it maybe more difficult to do a constitutional amendment, but putting some sort of safe harbor in for a citizen proposed law so that the legislature couldn't just turn around the next day and change it, which is the fear with going that route of a law. And that's why everybody goes toward an amendment, because it's so difficult to change. But that even, you know, had some pretty wide support and it went nowhere. So I'll be interested to see exactly what they come up with, if they come up with anything at the end of this session. I don't know.
I don't see what the problem is here. I mean, I don't see why the threshold needs to be increased. We're not California. The voters have turned back most of this stuff, as you all just pointed out up there in Columbus. I mean, it's to me it sounds like legislators wanting to have more power for themselves there, when it doesn't seem like there's any need to do that.
Well, Florida's actually another state where there were, like, I heard that there were several, I mean, upwards of 10 amendments on the Florida ballot because of this constitutional convention kind of group that Jackie was referring to. We had the Constitutional Modernization Commission. They didn't get to the convention stage of it or anything. But yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of groups that say, hey, we want to have this power. We want to be able to do this if we feel lawmakers aren't acting. And we're going to do it since we have to collect 305,000 signatures and spend all this money. Let's just do a constitutional amendment that lawmakers can't change as soon as we get it passed. And so it's tough.
And I think they're also, lawmakers are feeling some pressure from the groups that are having to fight these amendments that come in from out of state. The Ohio Chamber of Commerce has been the leading group in the last couple of years that has put up some money to fight these things. And I think, frankly, you know, them and others are tired of having to be the no campaign on some of these initiatives that, to be honest, are funded with mostly out-of-state money.
Okay. Howard, did you have a quick point on this?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you're going to get one of these petition-driven constitutional amendments passed, in your grassroots organization in Ohio, then you better have some very wealthy friends in California or New York or somewhere that can finance an extremely expensive campaign.
Yeah, statewide campaign with a lot of media markets in the state. So I want to move on. The election on Tuesday didn't change the basic structure of the legislature. There are some new people who are in. From the Columbus perspective first, Karen or Jackie, how much do you think the legislature is going to change because of Tuesday's vote?
Not much. I mean, there were five Democratic There were five Republican seats that Democrats were able to flip. Three of them were in the Columbus area, suburban Columbus. One was in suburban Akron, and one was in suburban Cleveland. So you'll hear the common suburban phrase there. But then Republicans were able to flip two seats in the Youngstown area, one in the House and one in the Senate. There's a handful, I think four seats in the House and one in the Senate that are potentially still up in the air in terms of being separated by a couple hundred votes. But really, Republicans are still in the supermajority in the House and the Senate. Democrats are in the superminority. And I think the first test could potentially be the possibility that there still might be a battle over who gets to be the House Speaker. Ryan Smith wants to keep that job. Larry Householder, the former Speaker, wants to be the Speaker again. And who would actually be able to get Democratic votes to come over, I think, is going to be something to watch, because neither Smith nor Householder has enough in a pure majority, I think, to be the Speaker right now.
One of those outstanding House races is down here the Cincinnati suburbs, Jonathan Deaver, the incumbent Republican, versus Jessica Miranda. I think there's, what, Howard, 300 votes, 400 votes between the two of them. Yeah. We have a lot of provisionals to count down here still, so the Democrats seem pretty excited about that.
Well, yeah, they do, for good reason, I think.
Yeah, Democrat, just to say this, upwards of 80% of provisional ballots are cast. It can even be as high as 90%, depending on the year. And typically, they do break more for Democrats than Republicans. So,
You
know, I think that Democrats do have a reason potentially to be confident in some of these races.
You can assume about 60% of them are going to end up being Democratic ballots.
And I think Deaver is a Householder person. You guys can correct me if I'm wrong. So that could impact that situation up there as well.
In fact, all of the House races, the five seats that Democrats were able to flip, those Republicans in those contests were all considered to be Householder allies.
Clarifying, Householder meaning
Representative Larry Householder.
Yeah, Representative Larry Householder.
And
yes.
Allied with Representative Householder. We have a caller who's called in with a question that takes us to a different area, and I think it's kind of interesting. Eric, what is your question?
My question is with the and hi everybody. But my question is with the changes with the seats being flipped and it kind of keeping Republicans in supermajorities, and with Governor-elect DeWine now, what is the outlook for labor? I'm a member of organized labor, and our main focus is one of our main focuses on issues that we care about is keeping Right to Work out of Ohio. And, you know, I'm curious what the panel's thoughts are on the future of Right to Work legislation and prevailing wage.
Okay, Chris, do you have a...
Yeah, I mean, I talked with the governor-elect about this before the election, and he pledged, and I think he said this in debates as well, he pledged to veto Right to Work. He said he did not want to be distracted by that, and if it was passed by the legislature, they would put it, you know, the labor would gather the signatures to put it on the ballot that year.
The last thing he wants is another Senate Bill 5 type fight in a midterm election.
Which is really interesting because it causes some heartburn amongst businesses, especially down here. Right. We're surrounded by right-to-work states, and they think that it makes it difficult to recruit companies here to Cincinnati.
We have about 30 seconds left, but Karen or Jackie, what's it look like on this question from Columbus?
Yeah, you know, I directly asked Mike DeWine this when he met with our editorial board meeting, and he, you know, feels that right-to-work is not necessary for Ohio to move forward economically. And that's a position that John Kasich has taken in recent years. So I think that, you know, as far as the man himself, he will take that position. Of course, there are other ways for this question to come up. It could be a citizen-proposed amendment like we were just talking about. It could also be something the legislature decides to put on the ballot. That doesn't need the governor's approval.
So we do.
There is likely to be a hearing on it, though, coming up in the legislature sometime in the next couple of weeks.
Okay, next couple of weeks. All right. So it's going to come up pretty quickly. I want to thank all of our guests today on both sides of the program. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. Technical director Josh Elstro. Archives of our program are available on the website wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.